This is Tim McHenry, producer of the Rubin Museum of Art, and you are listening to the Red Book Dialogues on WNYC's Talk to Me series.
I can't resist. I had never seen that picture before.
Which one?
The last one of your images with the tongues.
Yep.
So just in...
That's
in,
from the Red Book, by the way.
In honor of the shadow... Because I think the Jungian idea that you should always welcome the dark in. So in honor of the shadow, so that we don't all get too serious tonight, I've got to do this. Come on, it's a dialogue.
Okay.
You're not going to do it
so
back?
Sure. We'll do touching at the end of it.
Okay, well, I think... Now that we've shaken it up a bit, one of the things that I wanted to start with before I hand over the precious folio to Stefan is to bring in the words active imagination. And as you saw, the operative being active. But what Jung was engaging in his dialogue was termed active imagination. That's the name that he gave it. And it was very important for him that the images had their own autonomous energy, and to engage and discuss and engage with the images. And I just want to ask all of you who are participating with us tonight, and Stefan, when he gets the image, to really take the time to not immediately decide what the image is or what the image is saying and go up into that sort of, the first impression, the first little pigeonhole, but to see, even though these are not your own personal images, they're Jung's images, but to see how what they evoke for you and how you can feel your way into them. And as Tim was reading, the opening of the text for this image was listen. So I would call on you and on Stefan to actually listen to the image. And with that, Stefan, I'm going to make sure I've got it right. Here you go.
Okie doke. My thank you. This is really the first time that I'm seeing this. You guys see it too? I think I'm just going to sit here for 45 minutes and look at it.
Well, you won't be alone.
And then I'll have mastered this whole thing perfectly, no? I've heard before that some of these talks, some of them were more interesting than others, or some of them were outright boring, so...
You know that Sagmeister means teller of tales? Doesn't it?
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, I know by now you thought that I was joking, but...
I think the way each person approaches an image is actually unique, so...
I'm not sure if I can see if there's like hidden things from afar.
Okay. I'm going to join you.
Yeah, but I have too much mirror. No, I thought I saw something which I didn't see, I think. Okay, I think we can give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll start with the big obvious things. It seems there is a guy with a page haircut conducting a dragon, mm-hmm. or being in charge of a dragon. Mm-hmm. That person stands in a smoldering village, or a village that seems to be at the end of a fire, not quite burnt down yet, but it seems there is smoldering coals within those houses. And then there is a strange cut, which I can't quite decide if that's... No, it must be done on purpose, where the left, well, my left side of the image, same with you, but yours looks quite different. Well, the detail, I think I see more detail than you guys do. So where the left side is some sort of Swiss alpine chalet castle construction, or like a small version of The Shining with with strange lighting inside. So these are either colored glass windows, or one person has a candle going on while everybody else has neon lights or in their rooms. Mm-hmm. But the big deal clearly is the dragon. I would think that this dragon is somehow Chinese in origin. While the landscape underneath seems clearly part of Switzerland to me, including that alpine part that's coming out of that star where the dragon is dissolving mm-hmm. into. But the dragon looks very Chinese to me, meaning Chinese, you know, traditional folk dragons as you can see them in bronze or calligraphy. The entire dragon comes out of or is entwined, for one thing, with the Alps, but also with this gigantic star. And this is 8 or 16 pronged star, which I have no idea what the meaning of an 8-pronged star is, but I'm sure there might be one. Mm-hmm. And at the center of the star, a rounded cross with some patterns around it that looks more like a screw than a cross as you would know it from Christianity.
Well, if you had to choose a place to be in the image...
Oh, definitely in that little yellow room with the yellow light in
really?
the inside the alpine hut. Oh yeah, and it's
That's
cold
where
outside.
I chose there too.
It's, it seems very snowy and cold. Mm-hmm. So I have a huge fondness of warm rooms in cold climates. Or the literally the way I used to worry quite a bit at night. Mm-hmm. You know, about stuff that whatever happened today or is going to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And the way I got rid of that was by picturing myself driving through Siberia in a truck that's super cozy and warm inside. And there's all this, you know, crazy stuff going on the outside. Sometimes people attack the truck, but I'm like, super, it's a very safe truck. It's like double insulation.
What color was the truck?
It depends where it is in Siberia. It's almost it's always well hidden. So if it's in the snow, it's all white. Uh-huh. Looks like, from the outside, it looks like a regular truck as it would belong to Siberia, so nobody really notices it.
Uh-huh. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the decor?
The inside or outside?
The inside. Well, because the outside, it fits in with the rest of the...
The inside, oh, it's well fitted out. It has like a nice double bed in there with fresh sheets. Never
Egyptian
quite figured
cotton.
Out how I'm actually going to wash those sheets in a truck in Siberia, but that somehow, by the time that problem comes up, I'm mostly already nicely asleep. There's all sorts of storage place to store unbelievable amounts of food so that I never really have to leave the truck. Mm-hmm. You can go from the driving seat of the truck through a tiny little walkway towards the back of the truck, which is the living parts. There is a snowmobile attached to the end of the truck, so like for emergency cases, you can actually take, you know, little rounds. So the closest that I could see to that is definitely that little yellow window in the chalet.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Any more questions?
Yeah, I want to ask you if, because I was struck by something that that you've said, which is that you're interested in work that takes guts and that shows the guts.
That I said earlier than tonight, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I researched. Mm-hmm. So I just was interested in asking you if you thought that, you know, this image has, you know, whatever the gut means to you, what does it mean?
Well, I mean, I could say there is a guy conducting in there, and he's conducting in a village that is at the end of a fire, if I see this correctly. So, but I guess everything that I see is correct. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's the wonderful thing with these images. So I guess being able to conduct whatever is out there while your village just burned down is probably a gutsy move. I'm not quite sure. I mean, it seems that he's conducting the dragon, but the dragon is so clearly stylized that it doesn't seem very fear-inducing mm-hmm. to that person conducting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It seems more like a dragon of thought or a kind of a vision within a vision. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly this whole image is a vision. Mm-hmm. But the way that he painted this, there is a different kind of realism that he brought to the houses or to the person conducting or to that fairly ornamental, clearly not meant to be mm-hmm. real dragon. So I don't think that person needs a lot of guts to conduct this dragon, other than maybe the meaning of it, well, which probably would be likely, is that he is conducting, I guess it's a he, with he's conducting the dragon of his imagination or thoughts mm-hmm. or subconscious.
But viscerally, when you see it, it isn't something that you feel is frightening as a dragon?
No, it's far too ornamental for that. Okay. I mean, I place it as a dragon from within Asian art history rather than a dragon that was meant to be mm-hmm. a frightening one. Mm-hmm. It's a historic dragon rather than a real one.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I was wondering if you feel that Jung manages to bring the guts through.
Well, I guess the closest I could say to that would be being able to conduct your... Mm-hmm. I would think that being able to conduct whatever comes up from your subconscious mm-hmm. would probably need a lot of guts mm-hmm. and be true to that and follow through to it. Mm-hmm. But that I think I could only guess, because I don't think that I've ever attempted to do that. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm quite... Well, I read this fairly nice little analogy by a psychologist called Jonathan Haidt. Mm-hmm. He spoke at the same conference that I did at one time, and he talked about the conscious and the subconscious as a small rider on a large elephant, mm-hmm. and the small rider being thinking that he is, you know, he knows the way and he's in charge and he can tell the elephant where to go, but the elephant having his own mind mm-hmm. and basically doing his own thing. Mm-hmm. And that, Jonathan thought that through cognitive therapy or other areas of psychoanalysis, what could be hoped for is that the rider over time slowly is able to tame the elephant. Mm-hmm. And that this possibility of the rider and the elephant working together would lead to a full life, mm-hmm. where the conscious and the subconscious are really in tone, mm-hmm. or in tune with each other.
Well, my sense of this image is that it was, you know, that it's a moment that is not sort of necessarily in tune, you know, but it's a moment of shock and.
Where do you see the shock in here?
And awakening. For me, the shock is in this explosion of light more than anything. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was you were going to say something.
Well, see, from there I'm confused because mm-hmm. there is a clear desire for realism on the bottom third. And everything on the top, on the top two thirds is very ornamental, so I don't, you know, there it almost it seems like it's happening on some other level. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and it's difficult for me to. I mean, we talked about this just for a second before when we walked through the exhibit that. I'm not 100% sure why he actually went through the enormous effort and trouble to paint these out properly. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, from a design perspective, the sketches are much, much, much more beautiful, including also, I mean, typographically for sure, his handwriting is much better than his calligraphy. Mm-hmm. You know, he was clearly an amateur, mm-hmm. and it has all the trappings of amateur painting.
But this, in a way, was like a diary for him, mm-hmm. or a way of holding on to making real this process that he was living through. And I know you've said in other places that you keep a diary.
Absolutely.
And that diaries are important. Yeah. So how is keeping a diary... you know, how do you relate it to that? Why do you keep a diary, or why do you have that action repeatedly?
Yeah. I mean, I keep a diary like pretty much like for what most people keep a diary. You know, for one thing, for keeping a record. Mm-hmm. Very important for me is the possibility to be able to go back and see what I thought mm-hmm. 2 years ago. Quite often I see that things that I wanted to do something about change, I might still not have done, and I discover, oh my God, I was already thinking this 3 years ago, so possibilities that I eventually do something about it are bigger. Mm-hmm. It also, you know, offers this tiny, itsy-bitsy little bit of mini-meditation. Just a pause on Saturday morning when I write a diary for 10 minutes or so to reflect back on the week. Mm-hmm.
But what was it that made you start? Why did you start?
Well, I think originally I started with 12 or 13 uh-huh. And kept it fairly infrequently. And then when I was in Hong Kong, working in Hong Kong, so this was about 20 years ago, I read and I was unbelievably stressed. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, told the company that I know much more than I do.
What did you tell them you knew?
Well, I would say they made assumptions that I didn't fight.
Okay.
So I had a lot to catch up, and I had mm-hmm. many 16 and some 18-hour days on a constant basis. And I read in some silly little business magazine, it might even have been an in-flight magazine or some crap,
yeah.
Some little story about a Chinese businessman who said that the best business idea he's ever had was to keep a business diary. And that's really when I started to do this regularly. Mm-hmm. I just stole the idea from him. And in the beginning then took kept a business diary and a private diary regularly, and that seemed too fussy, so in time I merged them again. But the regularity kept alive, or was kept alive. And what I just wanted to say before was, why would you actually go through the trouble of, you know, if you keep a diary, why work so hard on the execution? Wouldn't it be much more spontaneous? Wouldn't the sketches be a much better representation of this? But then, of course, I realized that I'm basically doing exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
We've done over the last 7 or 8 years, by we I mean my studio, took particular sentences from the diary and then, you know, made them into pretty large, probably even more work-intensive elaborations than Jung went through here. Well, not more work-intensive than the entire Red Book, but let's say more work-intensive than this one. The reason we did that was because I wanted to make that particular sentence accessible to a larger audience. And I knew that if I just print that sentence, or well, copy that sentence in my handwriting and put it on a billboard, it's probably not going to do it. So maybe Jung's... And by the way, I'm by no means have the slightest desire to compare myself in any sort of way to him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible that he also wanted to, that he did this for, like, this manifestation of the sketch that he must have had in his diary for the consumption of a general audience or of a larger audience that's not just him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that the case?
Yeah, one could say it is the case. It certainly is a level beyond his diary, the one that he kept by his bed in the original sketches.
So I know I'm supposed to somehow open up unbelievably and reveal deep desires that were before completely unknown, and I feel I'm not quite doing that job.
Well, I hadn't expected you to, but now that you mention it.
What do you want me to reveal?
What you got?
Yeah, I don't know. Should I? I'm not sure if I have more to say about the image, other than Well, I have one thing to say about these sorts of images in general, and another parallel, which was I was surprised to see out in the exhibit. So that all of these images are, if I understand you correctly, are visualizations of visions that he had. Is this correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've already encounters from his dreams, active imaginations, but they all had tremendous meaning for him, because this whole encounter came out of a terrific loss of meaning after his period of a break with Freud, and really the loss of his status in the whole community of psychoanalysis, and so he lost his moorings. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was about how, and again, I don't want to compare you to him, but you make an effort to shift your moorings every 7 years. And, this is the result of him falling into this situation. But I was very interested in how you do this and why you do this 7 year and where that originated.
Well, we do this experimental year every 7 years. So we close the studio and the last one or the second one of these years until last September, I spent it in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for doing it is there are plenty. You know, like most big decisions have not just one reason, but probably a dozen. Among the most important ones are that I find it extremely helpful to make sure that my work remains a calling mm-hmm. and doesn't just deteriorate down into a job. Mm-hmm. And I see this specifically now that I have a ex-professor in the first role. and I also teach, I see it with many of my students that study design. There's specifically in grad school, most of the students see this as a calling. And I could for sure say that if I visit them again 5 years after they graduated, maybe most, but a good number, will have deteriorated into a job. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that this is, or it seems that this pretty much happens, this is not particular for design, this pretty much happens to everybody. Even if you actually find the thing that you want to do, just by repetition, I get used to it and adapt to it, and it's just not as exciting anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and doing these breaks with the possibility to experiment gets me out of that thing again, out of that adaptation process. So one of the things that I started in Bali was daily meditation, and I had no interest in meditation before that. It was more of a, you know, when in Bali.
Do as the Balians do.
And it took me a long while to get into it. I started with Buddhist meditation, and that didn't, just concentrating on the breathing was not really possible for me. Mm-hmm. There is too much going on in my mind that I could quiet it down just from concentrating on the breathing. So what I wound up doing was through first transcendental meditation, and then later on with a system from a US audio engineer with headphones that made the whole thing much, much easier. It's called entrainment, and it's basically you trick some brain waves to have a higher amplitude, and you get easier into proper meditative state. Mm-hmm. And I'm all for tricks and shortcuts. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that I also tried to visualize what's going on in my head mm-hmm. during meditation. Mm-hmm. And I hired a Indonesian motion graphics designer whom I just explained what's going on in my brain, and he made an animation out of it. And he, after some serious forward and backward, he got it pretty close. Mm-hmm.
So how would you do that? You would talk to him? And
yeah, I would make sketches.
At
and
the
I said
same
it goes,
time?
Yeah, and I make sketches, and I said it goes from here to here, and this is the speed, and this is the light, and this is the colors. And he got it very close. If I look at this meditation now, look at this visualization now, I'm so surprised how good I already was at meditating. Mm-hmm. Because now that I'm back in New York for 3 months, I completely deteriorated, or it's much, much more difficult. Not so much because of the location, I think. But I think it's just because it's so much more busy here, and there's so much more going on in my mind, mm-hmm. and it's much more difficult to stop it. Even though today in the morning I did have a fairly successful, as in enjoyable meditation. Mm-hmm. But that's been the first one in a while.
But what are the images like? Are they anything at all in this world that you're seeing that Jung is...
No, they're much less realistic. It's basically the view from inside a crater. So there's a lot of black around and it's oval, and you see outside of the crater, and that crater edge is changing the its size very slowly and constantly, and then there is various sorts of lights going on, almost like from a square chandelier that pop in and out. And at the edge of the crater, sometimes I saw semi-realistic imagery, as in silhouettes of people, I probably have it on a computer somewhere, but it's a tiny screen, so I don't think it's everybody would see it. So the desire, I guess, would have been somewhat similar. And when I commissioned this animation of what's going on in my head during meditation, I was unaware that of the red book. But the results couldn't be more different. I mean, I would love to see dragons while I'm meditating. Or love to conduct dragons while I'm meditating. Pattern-wise, there's a couple of strange things going on. I'm not sure if that is done on purpose, that this one last little square has this super bright red in there and a couple of squares up there, or if he just ran out of color and...
What do you think of the shape of the light?
I mean, the shape of the light of the star?
Because I was thinking, what do you think?
I don't know.
I was thinking a little bit like, you know, those, like a brain, or those images of the Egyptian kings or pharaohs.
You're talking about the little pattern that's around the cross?
Yeah.
See, this is so difficult to me because it's so much in ornamentic. And with ornaments, it seems that they are so culturally dependent that it's very difficult for me to have a personal view on it. You know, because every ornament has a just as much as color has a different meaning in every culture. You know, I mean, I just spent the year in Indonesia seeing swastikas everywhere, you know, being reproduced with no knowledge and definitely no meaning of what it has for the rest of us or for the rest of the world. And there I would know too little, or I mean, he clearly didn't desire to have a brain pattern, otherwise he would have painted a brain pattern, would be my guess. Or I myself, I don't know. I mean, the patterns seem familiar to me, but I couldn't place them. They probably could be wrought ironwork from some Swiss or Austrian graveyards that has wrought ironwork like this. That strange cross with that strange rounded cross. Well, I'm unfamiliar with it. But because it's so ornamental, it somehow removes it from a personal interpretation.
Well, I think it's very much what you were talking about before, of the different worlds.
Yeah.
The two... Let's see. I wonder if perhaps we should open this up to the audience.
Well, I have a quickie. It's a Swiss. Maybe it's a Swiss guy trying to be in charge of his Asian influences.
Though there's one question that I still need to ask Stefan, and since I've got him on the hot seat, I wanted to ask you, there's one image that stayed with me of something you've written, where you talked about the things that make you happy or the important moments in your life, and you talked about being in a pool with Viennese butchers. And ever since I read that, I'm trying to imagine how that ever happened and what you were doing. So maybe you can enlighten me since I have sat here with you.
Well, it's not a very deep story, but it's...
Well, it's an amazing image.
It was not a pool, it's a sauna. Uh-huh. And when we studied in Vienna, there's a large spa outside of Vienna called Oberla, where it's like kind of a wellness center that are very popular all over Austria, southern Germany and Switzerland. These are fairly fancy spas, but for massive amount of people, it's cheap mm-hmm. to get in, $5, and they have pools inside, outside, saunas, mm-hmm. and then for some extra money, you can get a massage, but they're fancy. And the one in Oberla had the Association of Viennese Butchers met there at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. And these guys gave the sauna official some money so that he would lock the sauna for the time that the butchers were inside, so that nobody would really leave and open the door, thus cooling down the sauna by a little bit, because the butchers liked it hot. And the first time I was out there, I mistakenly went in with the butchers, which meant the door was locked, and the only way you could get out was pressing the emergency button.
That's when you wrote on your chest and carved into it.
No.
No.
But what happened was that it was so unbelievably hot. Like, this is 110 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that means in Fahrenheit, but it's unbelievably hot. And And while the butchers were still telling jokes to each other, I was dying. And there was a moment when I had a choice of, should I get up and press that emergency button, or should I die? And I clearly choose death. Because by that time, I would have changed my mind. I was in no shape or form to actually be able to get up for the emergency button. But what happened was that if you're that close to go, if you suffer that much in the sauna, when the door finally is opened, make your way outside to the cool-off pool, it's an unbelievable experience. unbelievable. And I somehow only managed to be able to stay in the sauna that hot and that long to repeat that unbelievable experience of the cool-off pool with the pressure of the butchers surrounding me. So as to not look like a wimp in front of Viennese butchers. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I didn't mean to make a joke about the cutting into your body, but it's such a powerful image. And it seems to me, what comes up for me is the question of meaning. I mean, that why you chose to carve in those words, or there's something there about, you know, tremendous force to take
an
action like that.
That poster had many reasons. Uh-huh. First and foremost, of course, the desire of anybody who designs a poster is to make a strong image. Mm-hmm. I think that was definitely central to the whole thing.
But to suffer for it, or maybe you didn't suffer.
I can tell you. Designing a cover for Aerosmith was 10 times as painful. And it would make a fun story to go into details about that for another hour. No, yeah. But another reason at the time. See, this poster was designed for other designers. Mm-hmm. I'm normally not very fond about design for other designers, but this was a lecture poster, so reasonably designers would come. Mm-hmm. And this was in the late 90s, and the buzzword in design was process. Mm-hmm. That was what everybody was talking about. And I thought by considering the photograph this with an extremely high definition 8x10 studio camera where you could see every single pore and every single tiny hair and every single tiny blood clot, it would be clear to designers the process of how this poster was made would be very clear because it couldn't have been photoshopped. It would just have been even more painful. So therefore, the poster told, while having all the information, also quite elegantly the story of its making mm-hmm. with in a single image. And then there were other reasons, like this was a poster for Detroit, for Cranbrook, mm-hmm. and in the United States, the poster at that time was basically dead already. It's posters of this variety make no sense in a society that drives by car. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of sense in very dense European cities because everybody walks and you can actually see a poster like this. Mm-hmm. But somehow the poster was kept alive by designers who learned about design by doing posters in school. So even though the poster basically died officially probably somewhere in the 50s, it's still somehow alive. And if you look through design annuals, you will see 20% of all things are posters. Mm-hmm. And probably 90% of those posters are somehow design-related because designers love it. And whenever they get a chance, they talk their clients into, let's do a poster. And those posters, those design-related posters, or they're often lecture posters or inviting you to some design congress, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. At the time, most of them visually said what a happy and colorful profession we are all in. Mm-hmm. And I thought that in that sea of positivity, it might be worthwhile mm-hmm. to also show one that has a more anxious, more fear-driven direction, since that's definitely part of the profession.
Mm-hmm. But certainly you took it on yourself to experience that as you were going through it. I'm just so struck by how connected that is, you know, in this roundabout way to the image. Because as Jung talks about this image, he also talks about that having to sacrifice and surrender for the dark to bring in that, you know, that dark area down there. And actually, this is all emerging. This powerful serpent is emerging out of the dark and is conjured out of the dark. And so it's actually very fitting because I think that's really, in a way, what you're talking about. At least that's how I understand it in relationship to the, you know, your experience with the poster. He was, it's about sacrificing the solace that Tim was reading about at the beginning.